Welcome and good evening. Is this loud enough, do you think? Okay. First of all, of course, please turn off or at least silence your cell phones. Hope I did that. I'll check as soon as I sit down again. My name is Mary Ann Salmon, and I direct the MFA program in creative writing here at WVU, and it's my pleasure to welcome you this evening. Tonight, we come together for an important celebration, a reading by our 7 graduating writers from the MFA program. I'll be introducing the writers using the words of their professors and classmates, and I'll introduce them one at a time, which is a little different practice than in recent years, just so you know. And I felt a bit like a bird these past few weeks, gathering many bits of material, hoping to make a nest, or rather 7 nests, each a place of rest, a home, a perch, and more importantly, a launch pad, a place of departure. Sometimes it is a little sad to come to the end of a graduate program to make that departure. As Jesse Kelvitis told me, quote, about my time in the MFA program, I would do it all again, no question. But then she added, well, not really. That would be redundant. And I wrote back, yes, you did it. And once is enough. And enough is good, actually. When an MFA experience is positive, as I hope the one these writers have had has been, we hold it and one another in our hearts for a long time to come. Writing is just one thing that has been transformed. One another's stories and essays and poems, just part of what we hold in high regard. When I asked our graduating MFAs to tell me about each other, I heard about Christina's tenacity and Nathan's intensity, about Sarah's mix of the practical and the magical, about Troy's heart, about Jesse Lewis as a leader, and Jesse Kelvitis as a guide, about Rebecca as the shaft of light that eases into a room and somehow improves everyone and everything within it. And there was, over and over, great appreciation and affection and admiration for one another and for their teachers and for other MFAs. We have a lovely community of writers here at WVU. Tonight, we celebrate the achievements of 7 of them. I hope you enjoy listening to them, and that you hear something that stays with you. Now I'm going to introduce our first reader and then his thesis director, and then we'll do the ceremonial Master of Fine Arts hooding, which is awkward and interesting to watch. So get your cameras ready. Our first reader this evening is Troy Copeland. Troy is our interpreter of dreams, our guide into and back out of the mysteries of imagination and experience, of history and race, of girls. The stakes, Troy lets us know, are higher than we realized. Please welcome Troy Copeland and his thesis director, Kevin Oderman.
A couple of excerpts from an essay entitled, Where There's a Wheel. The prophet Ezekiel said he saw 4 wheels within 4 wheels in a desert storm, roiling with flame and lightning. They all moved as one. Meanwhile, each of 4 fearsome winged cherubim, the terrible living creatures of heaven, hovered near a wheel. And while cherubim, part man, part eagle, part lion, part bull, were closest to Yahweh himself, the avatars and emissaries of his glory, the prophet said that each creature's spirit inhabited the wheel, not its body. Ezekiel's encounter with Yahweh involved living wheels. In the flashing tempest, he saw the one invention most responsible for the Eurasian world's faster, more reckless lane in history's technocultural circus. Well, Big B always kept that black, gleaming 1971 Pontiac Grand Prix primed. The high king of the neighborhood, a former high school football Blue Devil lineman, Big B was big brother to all the young boys growing up in our quadrant of the neighborhood. Huge like a mountain, powerful. He taught me how to block and tackle. He introduced all of us to hip-hop, taught us how to play cards, and gave us our first lessons in drag racing. One sweltering Georgia summer, while home from college, he decided to take Poke and me on a ride to Columbus, man. Finally, old enough to road trip with me. This was more than mere bonding. This was our official introduction to adolescence. We were going to watch Full Metal Jacket. By the time we hit the four lane, hip-hop thundered. The open windows roared with cinematic Vietnam Born to Kill ahead and sleepy small town Manchester behind. I reveled in the moment. This was a big deal. At 13, I felt skyborn on the privilege of hanging out with one of the coolest human beings to ever live. But the redneck challenged that when he pulled alongside the Grand Prix, his blonde girlfriend beside him in the cab of his Chevy S10 truck. She looked over at us as we rolled along. Her Ray-Bans flashed. She smiled. The guy looked over, too. He didn't smile. Big B paid no mind at first. But then he noticed that it looked like the blonde recognized me. I was thinking the same thing. Suddenly, breathing felt a little more difficult. If she was who I thought she was, she might have recognized me for the middle school boy who had written her four letters. Some of them splashed with Polo cologne, declaring myself her courtly cavalier should she choose to exercise her 16 years of grace in commanding me to adventure in her name. But I couldn't be sure. She was wearing shades, after all. All I knew for certain was that there was something familiar about that smile, something recollected in that dizzying stupor to which it reduced me. And she was talking as the smile grew broader. Her driver leaned around her, leering like a goblin. "Who is that?" I asked. "Daniel." "Daniel Perinello," Big B shrugged. I knew the name well. One of the most popular white boys in town, Daniel was a senior in high school. He and his friends were the bad boys, hard drinking, hard swearing, fiercely fighting brigands, a veritable band of pirates in a fleet of souped up trucks. And there was no treasure in all the counties of West Central Georgia any more highly prized than his girlfriend, the illustrious Jenna. Jenna Rosinski. My stomach knotted. That's why the smile seemed so familiar. Jenna was the latest and greatest of my utterly unattainable childhood loves. B seemed to know more about this situation than he had ever let on. That was part of the king's job, after all. Yeah. I figure you might know him. At least you look like you know his girlfriend. What's her name? Jenna, I breathed. Jenna Rosinski. Yeah, B laughed. He had a girl, a full-grown college woman from Florida, a sister. Even in the full brunt of Mighty Jenna's smile, he was unimpressed. Whatever. Well, her boyfriend looked like he won a race. At that, I fixed my gaze on Daniel. He raised his arm like a spear, pointing down the vacant stretch of highway towards Columbus. The gauntlet was thrown. Again, Big B was not impressed. He took his time responding. The king of our block hurried for no one. Then he lifted only one finger off his steering hand to point and answer. Challenge accepted. Combat initiated. Without looking at either Poke or me, he muttered, "Put on your seatbelts." Poke and I howled. Jenna might have met my eyes with one lingering glance. I couldn't tell with her shades, but she did look over once more, grinning. Meanwhile, the S10 and the Grand Prix rolled side by side at about 70 miles an hour. Then the storm broke. Both cars launched into acceleration, wrenching the passengers back into our seats. Big B pushed the Grand Prix up to 75, 80, 85. But the adversary roared back. This would not be easy. As he pulled even, Jenna looked over at us, then whipped her head around, grinning, her hair flying. Daniel pulled ahead. "No!" I yelled. The S10 was leaving us. The pirate was talking trash now, laughing maniacally. I could only imagine what he was saying, and every imagined word infuriated me. Big B only smiled, though. He held steady at 85. "Man, what are you doing?" I screamed. "I got this." "Chill," he whispered. "I'm gonna let him go. Shit. Just let him go." The outrage. The Grand P was the fastest car on the block. The black, shining champion of our side of the tracks was too fine to lose this race. Big B was too cool to lose this race. What would Jenna think? What would Big B's woman at college, the sister from Florida, think? Daniel roared on. The distance between us grew. Big B held at 90, maybe 95. The villain pulled much farther ahead now and farther. by a mile, by 2 miles, so far ahead that I despaired. I just knew that we'd eventually lose him in the roll and curve of the land. How could this be? And Big B looked at me silently. Oh, ye of little faith, he seemed to think. Then grimly, now watch this. Hold on. And he floored the accelerator. Warp speed! My intestines began crawling up into my chest. Rage! The landscape to either side of the highway, the grass, the brush, the trees and hills pulled taut like a fabric spun in the mill of motion, and on went the Grand Prix. The singing highway now screamed beneath the tires. In ancient Rome, the most dangerous chariots were pulled by four fierce horses. The Grand Prix roared with the force of more than 400 foaming stallions, and on went the Grand Prix. Moment by moment, the distance between the prey and the predator closed, time and space collapsing in the warp and woof of inevitability, and on went the Grand Prix. 110, 115, 120, death was now probable. Had a deer darted into our path, it would have killed us all. A turkey, a large dog, a buzzard flying low. Any impact and the slightest effect of steering and we would have spun out, tumbling to our doom. But we didn't care. Suspended between life and death, the Grand Prix gained steadily on the S10. Closer, ever closer, still closer, until finally we were even again. Even! And all the passengers, Polk and me and Jenna, were wildly laughing, screaming, shouting, while our voices swallowed in the storm. I saw Jenna watch us as Big B claimed the lead. Of this I was certain. She watched as he pulled ahead. Daniel glanced once, twice, then maintained a steadfast glare down the road ahead. B didn't gloat. He didn't even look over to gauge his challenger's progress. One last gaze between Jenna and me. I pumped my fist. A last triumphant yawp. She smiled that smile of hers and shook her head.
Thank you, Troy. Our next reader will be Jesse Lewis. Jesse writes engaging, evocative fiction, not for the faint of heart. What is the line between past and present? What is independence? What is peace? With a visual artist's precision, Jesse explores these questions in her exquisite writing. Please welcome Jesse Lewis and her thesis director, Mark Brazidis.
Hi. Troy, I had to go after you. What? Well, I want to thank first my thesis committee, because they were really awesome, and I want to thank Mark, because pretty much I could just ask him anything at any time, and it was always an awesome response very quickly. No complaint. It was just amazing, and so much help from him, and Glenn Taylor for endless enthusiasm, just always there, and then Kevin Oderman for just always being able to see what I cannot in my work. It's always very helpful, so... And I want to thank the other MFAs for graduating with me, because you guys have influenced me way more than anybody else probably will. And then my family's here, and my fiancé's here, and they're fantastic. And putting up with a lot, because I'm getting married in exactly a month, and I've been going in circles, and so it's awesome to have support. It's really cool. So I want to read from She Spoke Wire, which is my thesis novel, starting off with Tig, this character that I just can't get out of my head, because I love him too much. Which, of course, I always put him through pain. It's so cruel. So, he is the neighbor's kid, the neighbor of the main character, Maeve. And they're standing in the woods like they always do. Tig dredged his hands in the leaves and stopped as though feeling something, gave a pull and revealed a length of barbed wire that had been buried at the base of the white oak. You ever try to gather this shit up? It's everywhere in the hillside. Not down by our house, but all over yours, he said. No, and I wouldn't try, Maeve said. Then she added, damn stuff. She liked the feeling of Tig's curse word. Saying it helped her. Somebody left it here just because he was lazy, and now it's ruined everything, Tig said. I bet you I could get it out of this place. Clear your land of it, then you'd never have to find it again. I'll get it out of here for you. No pay needed. He smiled at her with his nose scrunched. He put his hands on the wire so the barbs were spaced between his wrists, stood up, and started to tug. The wire rose up out of the leaves, tossing them in their dust. Then Tig began to follow it from one rusted end onward. He took his axe handle and began to wrap it like a spool so that the barbed wire made a rusty sound against its own bones. Maeve called to him, "Tig, I think we should get Daddy to cut it out." As he took the barbed wire's path in the opposite direction, following the creek bed, he called back, "No, Maeve, why, I can do it. I'm cleaning up your land. This wire ain't natural." He kept walking. The leaves rolled up in his wake. She ran to catch up. Tig followed it about a quarter mile, an easy track with only one small sapling grown into the wire. Maeve walked with him and was distracted by no trespassing signs caught in the rocks and beer cans at the bottoms rusted out. She paused when they headed to the top of the hill and then turned to look up at an old hawk. The bird sat up high in a tulip poplar and looked down at her, the spring wind tossing the feathers along his neck. "Hey," she said up to him, "hey, bird." But the hawk ignored her call. While Maeve watched the hawk, Tig fell. Small boulders had gathered after the ice age and nestled deep into the ground. They left divots and wells to stumble over, to break an ankle in. Tig rolled a bit and hit his knee hard on a rock, then called out, "Maeve, Jesus, Maeve," when he fell over an inch. He came to a halt at a dip between two rocks, a four-foot drop down to the ground between them. Maeve found him there in a bowl between the granite, where the barbed wire had gathered in a mass. It coiled on itself in yards and yards, where a cowhand had kept a pile that had turned into a nest over 50 years. The pile of wire was higher than Tig's waist, and that's where he stood, pressing his hands on the rock around him. "Oh, Jesus, Tig," she said, looking down over the rock. She was on her knees and could see the place where the barbs had gotten his jeans, caught them, dug past them. "I can't believe you didn't yell more." "Shut up, Maeve. You have to help me out," he said, and he put his rough hand up to hers and tried to wrangle his legs out of the trap of wire. He screamed when the wire tightened. He looked down at his legs, eyes wide. Maeve caught her voice in her throat just as Tig let out a yell. The wire pulled taut, digging deeper into his shins and knees. The axe handle scraped down the rock, pulled into the wire nest, and it sunk in. The wire breathed upward, and then squeezed again like a python. Tig cried this time as the wire put more pressure on his legs, tighter and tighter, blood drawing out into his pants and rolling down his ankles and into his socks. Maeve screamed, high-pitched and shrill, and pulled at his arm. At once, the wire let go of Tig. Instead, the mass of metal reared up as a lion might. Its body of wire was thick. Only bits of light passed through. In its blind energy, the wire was a great storm of old, rusted barbs. It broke into tendrils as though inviting Maeve to an embrace. Tig scrambled out of the hole, yelled his own yawp of panic, then ran, bleeding. Maeve followed, the great wire reaching for her just as she passed between two narrow beech trees. She kept going, following the slim rectangle of Tig's dirty back. She leapt over rocks and kicked off of a fallen pine log, then landed on her knees next to Tig when she was who was staring behind them. They waited a few seconds. The sound of the woods had gone dormant. The wire did not follow. Tig stood and helped Maeve up, and together they ran down the hill to a place along the creek bed that they knew well, where a boulder lay out in a thin ramp. It was just a jut of sandstone for moss and lichen to gather on. Maeve looked over her shoulder the whole way. It was here that Tig lay down and spread himself wide on the rock. Maeve saw his punctures, all 14, where the blood slipped into the denim and left kiss marks. Tig rolled his pants leg up. Maeve couldn't stop crying, though she tried desperately, squeezing her eyes. Tig looked up the hill for more movement, a rush of metal wire rolling down the hill. There was none. "Spell's over with," he said, when his breath came back. "Holy Jesus." "Goddamn," Maeve said. They breathed for a while, 5 minutes or so, letting their pulses drop, trying to convince the other one to be calm. "We need to go home and get you clean. Get those cuts cleaned up and then get rid of that monster up there," Maeve said at last, her voice a croak as she looked up the hill. Tig clapped the dirt off of his hands. Maeve traced her fingers between the cuts on his legs, connecting them. The punctures were along his shins in the odd shapes of stars. "My daddy will just be pissed," Tig said. "Tig, it's really, really bad." He stood in response. "And my daddy should see it, maybe. Maybe then yours doesn't have to, and then I can tell him about the wire eating you," Maeve said. Tig looked down at his legs. "They look all right to me." "But they aren't. They are, goddammit. I heal like nobody you know." He stood and started walking along the creek's edge. Maeve followed. "Well, what if your legs just get infected? That's how all those Civil War soldiers die." "I know. We learned about it," she said, catching up. "I ain't going to get infected. You sure as hell ain't going to convince your daddy that wire tried to eat me." "But it did try to," she said. "Sometimes," he said, "old people don't get it. And won't get it." He paused and swallowed, looking back in the direction of the wire pit. "Remember when that mourning dove talked to me, came and sat on my window sill in the morning, and asked if I had seen her partner bird? I told everybody about that, and my teacher said I had an imagination. Worse, my daddy told me I belonged in an asylum." He raised his eyebrows, a spot of blood on his cheek. "Nope," he said. "I just need to take care of these myself, in the creek. And we'll have to hunt the wire ourselves once I'm better." He let his speed gather until he was trotting. "Tig, come back. You come back now." He ignored her. and took a few running strides toward the creek. The water slow gathered and deepened into a small pool. It ran cold and dark with a voice. Tig crawled over the low creek at the bottom. As he stood between two rock ledges and braced himself, the water filled his wounds. Maeve ran after him and sat on a flat rock on the edge of the creek bed, crying again, watching him walk in the water. "Don't tell Daddy or your Daddy about this, okay?" he said, his legs paddling silver below the water's surface. She shook her head. "Maeve, goddammit, you can't tell them, okay? We won't be able to be out here anymore. Your Daddy won't let us run like deer anymore, even if mine doesn't care." She hiccuped. He took this as agreement. Tig climbed out of the water and stood next to her, his legs running muddy and red.
Thanks, Jesse. Our next reader is Jesse Calvitis. Jesse calls up this place, her Morgantown, seeing it from the inside. She honors it, and her attention opens our eyes, plants a seed, makes us want to do the same. Please welcome Jesse Calvitis and her thesis director, Kevin Oderman.
Give the tablet another shot. We'll see how that goes. I've done a lot of readings the last couple of years, so every time we have one, it's a challenge to find something that you haven't all heard before. I see a lot of new faces in the audience, but I see a lot of people who really don't want to hear army boots for the fifth time. So I have a lot of pieces in my thesis that are longer. I have 26, 28-page pieces. And then, much to, I think, Kevin's chagrin, I have some that are 750 words. So I picked one that's a little bit in between that I can keep under time, and you all can hear something new. So this is a short piece, weirdly, after the introduction, not about Morgantown. It's from when I lived in Pensacola, Florida for a while. It's called Bars, Pensacola. I put it on the to-do list in my mind rather than the one in the small yellow legal pad on my coffee table. Find a straight bar where I can take my parents when they visit so they don't catch on I'm spending all my time at the lesbian place up the street. It's been more than 6 years since the last time I moved to an unknown town and lived like a minimalist hermit. I've forgotten how much I enjoy the exploration phase. The map of places I can find again expands a little each day. Within one sandy, weedy mile of my house are a combination art supply and hardware store, a deep, trash-encrusted body of murky water that looks as though it should harbor alligators but apparently doesn't. The locals cut past it with no qualms, and a beautifully hideous stucco pink building, the color of washed-out flamingos. Beyond the Flamingo Building, I turn right and start looking. I need something forthrightly blue-collar and as quirky as possible. My parents know some of my tastes, at least. When I'm not specifically seeking a queer-friendly environment, the places I frequent have dollar beer specials, a bartender with grandchildren at home, and dingy bathrooms that are chronically out of toilet paper. Two blocks on, I find it. Hand-painted letters on a wooden sign declare it to be Jack's Bar and Grill. Pickup trucks and muscle cars fill the sand and gravel lot. Muted jukebox music drifts from the door. Some Hank Williams, then a little Metallica, then back to Hank. Looks promising. The special is Dollar Miller products, and the bartender is a slender, just-starting-to-wrinkle woman with wire-rimmed glasses and acid-washed jeans. As I relish my cold, cheap beer, I let the images and sounds of the place wash over me. I'm partly deciding if it'll do, and partly simply enjoying it. I wasn't always the person I am now, and for most of my life I would have flinched at the thought of a bar full of queers, my mother's term, or fairies, my father's. Even now, this everyday murmur of frustrated, weary people at the end of their work shifts or a long day looking, this is what's familiar to me. Familiarity, rather than breeding contempt, spawns an unsought sense of comfort, of relaxing tense shoulders and sharp eyes in a place where I feel, automatically and without question, at home. I feel that way in my usual bar, surrounded by women happily dancing, drinking, shooting pool, and eyeing each other with speculation. Irreconcilable as the two worlds are, I can't help but feel it here as well. The man to my right, tall and lean in denim and flannel, topped with a NASCAR cap, is talking about his neighbor's yappy little dog, which he's convinced has rabies, but somehow hasn't died of it yet. His friends, similarly attired and grouped around the end of the bar, laugh and agree with him. To my left, I hear the word sand nigger, directed at an ESPN commentator, spat violently from the lips of a boy barely old enough to be drinking. Across the bar, an elderly man in a polo shirt buys drink after drink for a woman exactly like the one I found in every bar like this. She's fighting a holding battle against middle age with the classic armaments of a tight, low-cut top, teased bottle blonde hair, heavy black mascara, and a piercing laugh. I think, as I always do, that she might be beautiful if she washed away the makeup and hair gel, traded old men and tequila sunrises for another hobby, and relaxed a little. The bartender catches up on everyone's drink and pauses in front of me for a cigarette. "Whew, been running like a dog today," she says, with a grin and a shake of her shoulders. Her movements tell me that this is her normal routine, that she'd be bored if it weren't. "How much longer you got?" I ask. I'm careful not to let it sound like a pickup line, though I've noticed her easy, confident smile and the fact that her body is muscular and unassuming. Any hint here that I'm interested in her for more than another beer would be fatal. Certainly in metaphor. Possibly in fact. I must have gotten the phrasing and tone right. The men to either side don't rise up with baseball bats and tire irons. The boy who muttered sand nigger doesn't turn to scream dyke. She answers, till 6, and glances at the clock. 4:30. I make the universal noises that mean tough break, and hey, not too much longer anyway, all in one. She makes sounds of agreement and wipes the bar. "Another one for you, hun?" She nods towards my nearly empty bottle. I push another dollar across the bar. 2 beers in the middle of the afternoon may not be the best idea, but I chalk it up to field research, to finding my roots, to the lethargy that comes with having nowhere else in particular to be. As I raise the second bottle, I see myself in the dark spotted mirror behind her shoulder. I know that with a shower and a change of clothes, I'd be ready to schmooze at the governor's mansion. I've done that a world ago. With a different twist of hair and a better shirt, I'd blend perfectly with a scattering of hopeful, timid women like me in the bar up the street. The ones not quite young, but not quite anything else. Here and now, though, I'm a gray shadow between two others. The man with the yappy dog story and one of his friends, and me, indistinguishable. My head falls an inch or two below theirs in silhouette, but the light from the door illuminates a matching trio of baseball caps, slightly hunched shoulders, tired faces edging towards philosophical acceptance. I can bring my parents here, I know, and it'll be fine. My mom will chat with the bartender the way she chats with everyone. They'll discover a high school friend in common, despite being 23 states and several decades away from their alma mater. Or mom's cousin will have had the same rare disease that the bartender's niece was diagnosed with last Thursday. Service will slow, and my dad and I will exchange the same amused glance we always do. Then we'll talk about old trucks. Yappy dog guy or one of the others will chime in, drawn to our disparagement of the new, the wasteful, the poorly built. "Yeah, Chevy ain't been worth shit since 79 or so. Computerized fuel injection? Who needs that?" I'll glance at the mirror again, sidelong as I order another dollar beer, curious to know which one of me will be looking back. Whatever I see, it will be invisible to the rest. The bartender will see only the shadow among shadows, the patrons another of themselves. My parents will see the daughter they know. And for the sake of peace, for the sake of something older than self and closer to home than this warm, sandy place, I'll let them.
Jesse. Our next reader is Christina Seymour. Christina's presence is a rare gift. From just over here, she observes and honors the lived moment, investigating its edges and finding the urgency and loveliness of spirit there. Please welcome Christina, and I was her thesis director.
Should I don't? Is this better?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, I'm a SAP, so I have some thank yous to get through. I first want to thank my thesis committee, Marianne, Jim, and Kevin. And I want to say something a little particular about each one. Kevin is the person that you want to sit, or I want to sit next to at a party, because he's no BS and no small talk, and I appreciate that about him. And he's like that with my work, too, and I appreciate that. Jim is the kind of person that you want at the end of an email, an insecure email. I find myself often writing things to him and then at the end saying, is this normal or is this okay? And Jim is the presence on the other end of that that's usually saying, like, this is all fine. You did fine. So thank you for that throughout my 3 years. Marianne is the person that you want listening to you because she often picks out the special things that you say, and as a poet, she feeds them back, and that gives you confidence in your voice, and that's essential as a poet. So thank you, Marianne. I also have to thank my MFA family. When my first year MFA family left, Lisa Beans and Evan Blake, I was scared of being alone, which is a theme in my work as well. But people like Jesse Lewis and Rebecca Dover Spike and all the third years, all the second years, Charity, Jackie, made me feel really at home. And workshop was always really fun, inviting, welcoming place. So I found my family here. So that's been very invaluable. And I can't forget to thank Brian, my significant other, who's been with me through these 3 years too. And he is one of those people who just seems happy without, like, it's in his genes to be fulfilled. And as a writer, that's something that I study a lot, and it provides a lot of material for me, as the workshop knows. So Brian's been a champ through these 3 years. So thank you. I love being appreciative, and thanks for making me appreciative tonight. I have about 8 poems to read. Well, exactly 8 poems to read. And I'm going to start with a title poem. It's called, my thesis title poem is called This Perfect World. This Perfect World. 2 black wolves on sifted snow wander to the edge of a geyser, pump their front paws, shake off 7 strands of short gray hair. I thought once that their eyes, moons of fig and sun, could make me beautiful, or unfreeze my hope from its still socket, make me feel a limber ladle of awe. I would walk on river grass, tongue swimming, warm in the county of my mouth, eyes tied only to my sears, 1 string stitching my blood to my heart. My eyes, no one would want to sever my 1 string stitching my blood to my heart. My eyes would say, without trying, I am someone too. Sitting alone at the lake. The sun sprinkles on the water like the yellow hybrid rose by the same name, the cricket the same color as the rock. A boy discovers his own shadow in the waves of the lake. Girls on a raft trailing behind a jet ski were taught by history and habit to do 1 of 2 things if they fall: stay calm and float, or panic toward another. Mountains like a small rash crowd over spots of life, talking and wearing colors. The clouds, a breath stronger than gravity, stitch little feet to uneven rock, my back to my beach towel. I wonder if anyone else saw the green, the blue, the girls on the jet ski who might fall, the lake, the cricket, the rose, asking us to listen closely and wait or reach for someone else's hand. No plans, and the trees are no help. The robins seem to ask if I feel any better. No, I answer. I liked that when my friend called, it was all about her. Daffodils spring up lovingly through a tire. Through knitted trees, evening lovers walk. There are just as many colors of bottle caps in gravel as there are in the river, blue, green, red of a thrift store sweater. Neither shade from a maple nor standing still changes being alone. The stranger used memories like crayons to color his white prison cell. We held slugs in our palms, even if the woods don't care. Feeling a lack of feeling is also worth committing to. Those three poems were from the first section of my thesis, and the next two are from the second section, and those are the more love poems. And these two were written in Charity's presence at the Blue Moose Cafe, and she told me to look at some Rossetti paintings, so they're inspired by Rossetti's. This one's called We, W-E. Roses on her harp become her red hair, as other same faces look down, as I look down the bridge of my nose, saying, why can't this be better? Why can't the curve of my hand lilt over golden strings like hers? Why can't you sit above me on a hill and see me the way they see her, see the doubt in my eyes and lick it up with looks of longing? The weekend we drove to find haystacks was the first time we saw each other since the first time we began. You and me. I don't think I could be a racy redheaded lover model found in the Rossettis my friend admires. If I was that for you, I wouldn't be sure which of my hands smoothed your back in the sigh of midnight, or which yes was really a yes. The lonely man on stage starts to pick his guitar, the squeaky bed springs of guitar strings, and you might be home napping. I wouldn't be sure which no to choose, or which songs on the radio to listen to think of you. A tea-stained wooden stir in a glass is just that. You are leaning on my edges, pressing my form into another's, and I am staying fully formed. She was young with me. The light in my dream was that orange of a street lamp, the one young girlhood friends swear by. I couldn't think of how to say tires churning gravel until the recycling went this morning. It's easy to say, take what I've got, but take what's already gone is a smoke in the throat wish, one less hope. I must have felt lost, not just drowsy last night, but since I walked away the last time from the park under the stars, your swing and my swing doing nothing. Two more. These are both newer. What is desirable? An acoustic guitar makes just that sound of dealing with or driving through fall trees. On long Sunday drives with my dad, my brother and I in the back seat, put our hands out the window to the rain to feel a safe, spiky hurt. We thought, this is adventure. And still, it is to me, a hidden side street, a piece of weather touching my cheek, the newness each time. It's been so long since the drive felt long enough. I am making all the choices now. The boundaries around aimlessness are not my father's, but mine to trust. After a long phone call. The tree is that maroon, the one in fair weather against a beveled sky. I found a new tulip today, tucked into its star shape, suffering a shine down from an early moon. You waited inside for me to find my conscience and quit pushing for an answer. Once I've done all my fixing, it's time to fix you. And as quickly as the slick aviary of blackbirds in your eyes blanks out the pain of someone blaming, I come to realize each painting needs an access point. Each yearning needs a ground to grasp. If I might design a happiness, it would be last Sunday when I found a loose beagle near a busy road and walked him home. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Christina. Oh, my goodness. Our next reader is Nathan Holmes. Nathan tells a fantastic story, futuristic, speculative, sci-fi, too strange to be true, or too strange not to. What happens next? We want to know. He has our attention. We turn the page. Please welcome Nathan Holmes and his thesis director, Mark Brazidis.
Hello. After that introduction, I feel like I should be reading something more speculative, but this is something that I pillaged from a different story that is a little more, I guess, normal and a little light, you know, so, and it's the right length, so. Before I get going, you know, I just wanted to say thank you to everyone, especially people in workshop have been just so helpful and, you know, just provided so much insight and, you know, I feel like I'm just such a better writer after leaving here. Thank you, Glenn and Mark. Ethel is not here, but, you know, amazing committee and just amazing professors. So thank you, everyone. So this story, it's called The Good-Smelling Woman. Pam finished her shower at 6:30, giving her some time to get ready for the movie at 7:15. She had washed her hair several times and scrubbed her body with a sponge before rubbing herself down with a pumice stone. When she got out and went to the bedroom dripping, her skin shone red and raw in the light from the windows. From the closet, she picked out a t-shirt, cardigan, and capris, laid them flat on the bed. She took a pair of scissors from the nightstand and hunched over the clothes, ran her fingers gently over the seams of the fabric. She used her middle and ring fingers, since the tip of her index was wrapped in a band-aid from where she'd clipped the nail too closely and drawn blood. Along the collar of the cardigan, she found a protruding thread, which she pinched, pulled taut, and snipped away. She continued to check over the rest of the fabric, her face a few inches above, her fingers running over the seams. Near the base of the capri, she found another stray thread, which she snipped before finally getting dressed. At 7, she took her dog, Drava, on a quick walk out front. It was too warm for the cardigan, she realized, but it would be cold in the theater. In fact, she probably should have worn full-length jeans instead of capris, but it was too late to go back inside to change, and she'd already checked over her outfit for tags and loose threads, so she let Drava inside and went to the car. On the way to the theater, she had trouble focusing on the road due to a tiny speck of dirt in the middle of the windshield. She set the wipers to full speed and sprayed fluid several times, but her wipers were old and worn out, so the speck remained. In the parking lot of the theater, when she stepped out, she brought with her a tissue, leaned over the windshield, and scrubbed away the speck, which actually turned out to be the adhered corpse of an insect, tiny wings like dabs of glue baked against the glass. She tossed the tissue into the trash can near the entrance of the cinema and felt better, knowing that her view on the drive home would be speck-free. At the box office, she waited in line behind two businessmen in slacks and scuffed loafers, here for an after-work feature to decompress. Pam herself wore flats that she could easily slip off in the theater and pull her legs up into the seat as long as no one sat beside her. The two men were seeing the same film as Pam, and after purchasing her tickets, she again stood behind them in line for snacks. She bought a small soda and bag of Twizzlers, then proceeded to the ticket ripper who was chatting with another employee and didn't acknowledge Pam when she approached, but Pam didn't mind. She knew where to go to find her theater. She came here often. Movie going was one of her favorite activities, despite the fact that the entire place was covered in carpet. She hated carpet, especially the feeling of it, the thought of tender, dry skin touching against it, those twisted tufts rubbing against flesh. And here, carpet was eerily ubiquitous. She sometimes felt that the pervasiveness of carpeted floors in cinemas was some sadistic architectural conspiracy designed to torment her. Each theater was only accessible through a narrow hallway completely wrapped in carpet, floors, walls, ceiling, covered in dingy red sisal. Whenever she entered these halls, Pam got nervous that some catastrophic event might occur, an earthquake, a terrorist attack, a collapse of some kind. She'd be trapped in the carpeted hall with only a soda and Twizzlers with which to survive. But she made it through without incident, paused at the foot of the stairs to survey the seats. Most of the central spots were taken, but Pam never sat in the middle because it was more likely that someone would choose a seat next to hers, and then she couldn't sit cross-legged without her knees overflowing into the person behind beside her, and she'd be miserable for the entire feature. So she crossed to the other side of the theater and found a seat two-thirds of the way up to the top, off-center, behind an elderly couple who, together, emitted a scent that Pam interpreted as a combination of hairspray, perfume, and musk. Not unpleasant. From her seat, she watched each group or couple enter and climb the rows, as if staring them down would ward them off so they'd sit elsewhere. A young couple entered the theater and climbed to the same row as Pam, but sat several seats away. By the time the room darkened, no one had sat too close, and she let herself relax. When the previews ended, a lone man entered from the hall, crossed the theater, and made his way up the stairs until finally selecting Pam's row. He chose a seat between her and the young couple, still two seats away, so Pam would be able to cross her legs and sit how she wanted, but she considered his close proximity slightly uncomfortable. When the feature began and the lights dimmed even further, she slipped off her shoes and pulled her legs up. She glanced at the man in the row beside her, and in response, he looked over and smiled sheepishly, as though to take the awkwardness out of the fact that they had looked at each other for no reason. He looked back at the screen and took a sip of his soda. The elderly, good-smelling woman in the seat in front of Pam shifted her body, and Pam couldn't help but notice that the woman wore a wonderful, soft-knit sweater, yellow and thick. Pam resisted the urge to reach out and touch the fabric, to compare the actual feel of it to how she imagined it felt. She thought that after the show, she would strike up a conversation with the couple for the sole purpose of finding a moment in which to lay a hand on the woman's shoulder or arm. While she imagined some possible opening lines of conversation, the movie began. In the first light of the film, Pam noticed a stray strand of thread sticking from the seam of the woman's yellow sweater, a rather long thread that caught the light from the screen and glowed. Without hesitation, Pam reached for her purse to take out a pair of fabric scissors she always kept with her. She fit her small fingers through the rings of the blades, but then she realized what she was doing and stopped. She took a breath, tucked the scissors away again, and did her best to focus on the screen. After another few minutes, she glanced down at the thread on the woman's shoulder. It really did seem to glow in the light of the screen, and Pam imagined that if she were in the rear of the theater with no one to either side, she could easily snip the strand away, and no one would notice. But the woman would look all the better for it, and Pam would be satisfied. But she was worried that someone would see her. The man two seats over might glance at her again and notice her reaching between the seats with a sharp metal object, a blade, that would glint in the light of the projector. Or worse, the woman's husband would see the scissors in the edge of his periphery and recoil, as he well should. Pam's scissors were not cheap or childproof. They were sharp, 4-inch titanium-bonded embroidery scissors. They could snip away a flap of skin so easily that you wouldn't feel the cut until it started to bleed. But Pam forced herself to look up at the screen again, struggled to focus on the film, but the thread was so long and protruding, like a thin strand of hair sticking up on top of someone's head, impossible not to notice, demanding to be smoothed down, an exigency in itself, like someone with food in their teeth. It would be rude not to tell them. "You have something just there," you'd say, and "Oh my, thank you," they'd respond good-naturedly, before tonguing and sucking their laterals and cuspids, just as the good-smelling woman, if she were acquainted with Pam, would thank her for snipping away the offending thread on her shoulder, and "Oh, it's nothing," Pam would say. "I always carry a pair of scissors with me. It just ruins my whole day to have some awful tag scratching or some little thread tickling," and the good-smelling woman would smile, "I know just what you mean." And with that thought in mind, Pam reached into her purse and took out her scissors, very discreetly, palming them to ensure they wouldn't glint. She held them low in her lap with her packet of candy. When the next dark scene appeared on the screen, the room dimmed, Pam reached forward with the scissors. She spread the shanks with her thumb and bandaged index, guided the blades toward the thread very slowly. The good-smelling woman shifted to the side, and although Pam's scissors didn't touch her, from this new angle it would be more difficult to make an accurate cut. The thread was no longer directly between the seats. Pam would have to curl her wrist around the seat back and reach at an angle to successfully snip. After a moment of hesitation, she decided to make the attempt and reached her hand forward again. The scissors glinted as the screen brightened into a sunny scene, but she had guided the blades so close to the thread that she couldn't stop now. She extended the scissors carefully forward, spread her fingers. She slid the crux of the blades against the thread and snipped it at the base, a perfect cut. Slowly, Pam began to retract the scissors, very carefully, closing the shanks of the blades, guiding them around the curve of the seat back again. But then the woman shifted, her body moving too suddenly for Pam to react. The woman's shoulder jabbed into the tip of the blade, and her whole body jerked. All at once, Pam snatched her hand away, palming the scissors in her lap. A small speck of red blossomed against the pale yellow fabric on the woman's shoulder, and the woman's frail hand reached over and gripped the wound. The woman turned and looked back at Pam, but Pam stared straight ahead at the screen and held her breath. After a moment, the woman faced forward again, and Pam allowed herself to breathe. She looked over at the man beside her, two seats away. He was looking directly at her, no hint of sheepishness, no awkward smile. Pam looked away and faced forward again until she was sure the man had also returned his eyes to the screen. Below her, the good-smelling woman shifted uncomfortably, her hand still clutching her shoulder. Pam tucked the scissors back into her purse, slipped on her shoes, and when a dark scene dimmed the theater, she stood and sidestepped out of the aisle, leaving her soda behind. She wanted to run down the stairs and sprint from the room, but she walked very slowly down the steps, step by step, then slowly started across the carpeted floor toward the hall on the other side. The screen flickered, and there was a sound from the speakers like someone tumbling to the floor, collapsing. And in that moment, Pam stumbled, and the audience laughed, and Pam turned to face them, glaring through the light at the jeers, scowling with lips pressed to a grimace. But she could only see the flickering lights of the projector and the shadowy outlines of bodies and seats. When she finally reached the carpet-walled hallway, she ran. Thank you.
Nathan. Our next reader is Sarah Lucas. Unsentimental, honest, evocative, accurate. These words describe the world Sarah has created in her novel, a world wholly her own, and importantly, recognizably, sometimes heartbreakingly, ours as well. Please welcome Sarah Lucas and her thesis advisor, Glenn Taylor.
Which way?
How's that? Is that good?
Yes. It feels great. Well, I don't have anything as exciting to read as a movie theater stabbing. That was awesome. Thank you. And in fact, some of you have probably heard some of what I'm going to read before. But my novel, Wheatfield, is about a town called Wheatfield, a small town similar to where I grew up, but obviously not because it's fiction. But we follow the lives of two characters there, Marcy and her husband Ray. So I'm going to read a little bit about the town and then a little bit about Marcy and Ray. But thank you. Home of the Gleaners. At the edge of town, zip-tied to a length of chain-link fence, is a sign that proclaims Wheatfield, home of the Gleaners. The sign is green with reflective letters that barely glow at all when struck by passing headlights. The sign is older than most of the people that drive by it. The sign was put up, as an afterthought, by the highway department to separate wheat fields from Wheatfield. People not familiar with the area couldn't tell the difference and passed Wheatfield only to end up in real places, real cities, miles down the road. Even after the sign was put up and nobody could miss what the town was called, people didn't stop. Wheatfield was once a real place, too, although it's hard to tell by looking at it these days. Once there were blue-collar jobs in factories and on family farms. There had been white-collar jobs, too, jobs for people that kept everyone working the blue-collar jobs on track. Someone has to organize everything and keep the books. Once, people in Wheatfield had disposable income. They had jet skis and boats, which they hitched up and drove away to enjoy on lakes and rivers several counties away. Only on the weekends, of course. Weekdays were for work. When the economy went south on everyone and people all over the country found themselves struggling to get by, everything went wrong in Wheatfield, too. The factories closed down, the family farms stopped producing, the white-collar folks found themselves with very little to organize and nothing to keep in the books. Weekdays became days for job hunting, and weekends were left to themselves or to cases of lukewarm bush light. These days, there are blue-collar jobs in gas stations and on big farms. Now, all of the white-collar jobs are in real places far away from Wheatfield. Nobody remembers what having disposable income feels like. The jet skis and boats just sit in people's front yards, festooned with for sale signs bought at the Dollar General, their owners unable to drive them away. Gas prices are too high. When the factories in Wheatfield were open, they made parts of car parts. The internal parts of radio knobs, the covers for air conditioner buttons, the little motors that moved automatic rearview mirrors. When the factories closed, people who had been working all of their lives suddenly found themselves sitting in job interviews faced with questions like, what did you do in your last job? What were you responsible for? When they answered, I put the green tape over the holes in the back of the air conditioner buttons, or I stuck the metal piece into the slotted plastic piece of the thing that moves the seats. They found themselves still out of work. The truth was the wrong answer. Nobody hires metal piece sticker inners or green tape peeler stickers. The family farms used to grow wheat and raise cows, but the government stopped handing out subsidy to small farms. People who had been working their family's land all of their lives suddenly found themselves in job interviews faced with questions like, what is your highest level of education? And would you be willing to go to college? When they answered, I just went to high school, they found themselves still out of work. Nobody hires people with a high school diploma. The white-collar folks flat out packed up and left. They didn't have to die a little bit during job interviews. They just found new jobs, or else new jobs found them. The white-collar people got hired. They took their boats and their jet skis and moved away, leaving everyone else in Wheatfield to organize themselves, and they didn't leave any instructions. These days, the streets of Wheatfield are cracked and riddled with potholes because people don't pay their city taxes. The streets were never that good to begin with, so people don't really mind the roads much. It's the look of the houses that makes everyone remember what a sorry state they're in. Back when times were good, the houses in Wheatfield were considered nice. People planted flowers in little gardens. They painted their front doors and shutters with the bright colors they saw on home improvement shows. They watered their lawns and pulled out the weeds. Everything was covered in a fine gray film that came from the factory that made the foam for the SUV seats. But it was a noble filth. It showed that people had jobs. It showed that people earned what they had and could pay for what they wanted. Gritty brown dirt and signs of disrepair have taken the place of the gray film of prosperity. Flakes of once bright paint freckle the dirt of barren flower beds. Weeds grow waist high in yards, both front and back. Nobody has the money to water lawns. Lawnmowers get sold in the winter to pay for fuel oil. People remember how things used to be. They gather in the homes of friends and family and tell stories about what Wheatfield used to be like. They remember the sounds of the factories and the small farms. They remember what tomatoes grown in their backyard taste like. Everyone is nostalgic. So this is a little bit of Marcy and Ray. This takes place in April 2003. Most of the novel, or the present action, is in 2003-2004. The rest of it, we kind of see Marcy and Ray when they're children, but we're kind of going to walk into them early in their marriage. So signs to watch out for. The day that Ray got fired from the egg farm, Marcy threw up on the floor next to their bed. She knew something was wrong. Ray was never home before 3 o'clock. She stopped scrubbing the rug. He took the stairs two at a time and burst into the bedroom out of breath. "Hey," he said, "what's this? What's wrong?" He sank to the floor, kneeling beside Marcy. He patted her back softly, resting his hand just below her shoulder blades. The sharp smell of manure swirled with the chemical smell of the carpet cleaner, and she almost threw up again. He uncurled her fingers from around the scrub brush and stood, pulling her to her feet gently. She wore one of his old T-shirts. It was dirty. Less than 24 hours ago, she was sitting in a hospital bed refusing Jell-O. When the nurses told her that they wouldn't let her go home unless she ate something, she ate it. By that time, the Jell-O was warm and half-melted from sitting out all afternoon. It was green and tasted like green, not like lime or apple or some other green food, but like the artificial color green. To get the flavor out of her mouth, she ate a peanut butter and jelly sandwich without crust that Ray bought from the vending machine in the waiting room. It was another compromise. The nurses wanted her to eat a full meal, but Marcy couldn't stand the thought of mushy string beans and gray cafeteria meatloaf. The nurses made her walk around and use the bathroom, proof that her digestive system would be able to function without medical supervision. Ray thought this was funny and laughed, the first time he'd laughed in days, as Marcy stood next to the low toilet in a hospital gown and socks not flushing. But Marcy didn't laugh, and Ray felt bad for trying to make light of the situation. "I'm sorry," he said. "I'll get you out of here just as soon as I can." When they got home, Ray carried her to the couch in the living room and tucked her under the quilt. He got a glass of water and the remote to the TV. Not that it really mattered. They only got a few channels with the antenna, and Marcy wasn't in the mood for watching television. She heard him walking around upstairs, in the hallway, in the bedroom. He paused a long time in the bathroom. She knew he was making sure everything was okay. In the hospital, she heard him tell the nurses that he had taken care of everything at home, cleaned everything up. But there wasn't really much for him to have worried about. When everything happened, it had happened so suddenly, and she'd been so panicked that when things got really bad, she was already at the hospital. Still, Ray was worried. He wanted everything to be okay. He wanted her to get better and to not have to think about any of it. The nurses gave Ray a checklist of things Marcy might need and instructions on how to care for her, signs to watch out for. The nurses had also given him a white paper sack full of pads and said that she would probably need more. Marcy tried to talk him into stopping at the drug mart on the way home from the hospital. She insisted that she felt well enough to go into the store, that she could take care of this by herself, but he took her home first because he wanted her to rest. When Ray came down the stairs with a box of tampons and a package of panty liners, Marcy almost laughed. He looked lost, overwhelmed. "Which one?" "Neither," she said. "Get me a piece of paper. I'll write it down for you." "Okay," he said, and he took Marcy's note to the Drug Mart, where Anita Smalley helped him buy enough pads to last Marcy the rest of her life. Ray's a little bit tragic, in case you haven't figured that out. He also picked up a box of sugar-coated Easter chicks, her favorite. Now she stood on the rug in front of Ray, nauseated, the Percocet ripping through her stomach. "I'm really dirty," she said. There was still bright yellow vomit on her shirt and some on the floor. "You probably don't want to be in here." "Have you looked at me? I just came from an egg farm," Ray said. He smiled and rubbed her back. "I've got to clean the rug," she said. "It's okay. Don't worry about the rug. I'll take care of it." He led her into the bathroom, flipped the lid of the toilet seat down, and helped her sit. He turned on the water for a bath, the steam rising up toward Marcy as he went back downstairs. When Ray returned to the bathroom, he was wearing only his boxers and carried a big plastic cup, a big blue and white cup he brought home from Carter Price's bachelor party at a college basketball game. Marcy had tried to throw the ugly thing away at least 3 times. She hated the smiling holographic mascot. "I thought I got rid of that," she said. "Nah," Ray said, and helped her up from the toilet. "This too hot?" Ray dipped the cup in the tub and offered it to her. She stuck her finger in the water. It was too hot, but she wanted the heat. "Right now," she said, "it probably couldn't be hot enough." "Okay," he said. "Let's get you in there." He peeled off the t-shirt and threw it in the little trash can beside the toilet. He held her around her waist as he leaned down to help her step out of her underwear. "Let me get that," she said, suddenly feeling embarrassed. She tried to push him away with her elbow to turn away from him, but he held her closer. "Shh," he said. "It's okay." She stepped out of her underwear and he threw them away, not even looking at them. He helped her into the water. It was hot, but she held both of his hands and sank back against the warm cast iron tub. She hadn't taken a real bath or shower in 2 days. In the hospital, the nurses led her into the bathroom and hosed her off with tepid water, just barely enough to get wet, but not really enough to get clean. They hadn't bothered washing her hair. Ray sat on the toilet. "I've only done this with puppies and steers," Ray said, trying to make a joke. But Marcy's eyes were closed, and she didn't speak. "That feel okay?" "Mm-hmm," she said, and she meant it. The hot water worked on her sore spots and cramps and knotting muscles that had been working nonstop for days. Ray took the cup and dipped the water over her shoulders, over her chest. He lifted each arm carefully and poured hot water over it. He cupped his hand around each ear and dipped water over her head until her hair hung in sheets in front of her face and across her shoulders. "I could have taken a shower," Marcy said. "You didn't have to do this." "I know," Ray said. He squirted shampoo in her hand, and she washed her hair while he held her up with one arm around her back. He rinsed it for her and handed her a washcloth and a bar of soap. Marcy felt like she might break into a million pieces. "You didn't have to do this," she said. "I know," he said. He took the washcloth from her and washed her neck and her back. Marcy hadn't been given a bath since she was a little girl. It made her feel helpless and loved at the same time. It made her sad. Thank you.
Our next reader is Rebecca Doverspike. Essayist of How We Meet and What It Means or Might, Rebecca sees others full size, each a share of grief, a share of glory. Looking for the light, she finds it. Please welcome Rebecca Doverspike and her thesis director, Kevin Oderman.
Hello. Similar to Christina, I also love being appreciative and having something to appreciate, so I have a few thank yous. Thank you to Kevin for being such a generous reader who inspires me to see inside a text and what its most meaning to be. For opening me to experience further, he said recently in a conversation, meaning is all around us, and I love that. Marianne, whose poetry workshop and friendship has affected me profoundly in my life, I learn from her dedication, skillfulness, and grace on a daily basis. Katie Fallon, such warmth and such a wonderful invitation into this program. And, of course, my friends, and I wish I could name all of you individually. Jesse basically created a new form of laughter in me, which is, like, such a gift. Sarah for being such a kindred spirit, and Troy and Christina, and all of you as well. And my family, my mom and my brother are here. And today we had a wonderful day, and I was refreshed to realize we're such problem solvers. It's like, I can do anything. Okay, so this is an essay that I wrote in my first semester here about actually my impressions of Morgantown when I first moved here. So some of this has changed and some is the same. After moving to Morgantown, West Virginia for graduate school, I stood waiting for the bus at the local Dairy Mart. Its brick walls hazy with the humidity of late July. I'd only been in Morgantown for about a week, and I'd had a dream about being lost the night before. The place was so new to me that the dream world shaped it as much as the waking one. I stared at the Dairy Mart and pictured the garage doors that used to exist where the brick wall is now, when it was an Amoco. I didn't know this from my own memory, but from a woman who works there. 2 days earlier, after making it up the wooden stairs of Whitmore Park, from the broken glass shards along Forest Road Alley, I took the wrong street. I was not used to Morgantown's crooked, narrow passageways that left me out of breath. I passed houses, sweating, trying to find a road that would lead and reconnect to a main one. No such outlets. So I found myself trapped midday in stifling humidity on the side of a busy two-lane highway. A cornfield on one side and endless miles of used car dealerships on the other. I thought I saw a gas station, so I walked toward the Sunoco sign, imagining a map on a wall, a "You Are Here" pin, only to find it gutted out, gas station transformed into a mechanic shop. I asked one of the mechanics for directions, and he drove me down the road. He dropped me off at the Dairy Mart on Richwood. I walked into the Dairy Mart drenched, slightly delirious and relieved after hours of walking uphill lost. I knew my way from here. I was the only customer in the place. "Oh," the woman behind the counter said, "you must be the one he was talking about this morning." "I was here for coffee this morning," I recollected, though it felt like days ago, or maybe only in last night's dream. I was exhausted from traveling, from the constant unexpectedness that comes with newness, as if my body had arrived before my mind. "Just focus on her sleeve," I told myself, an old trick. "My boss said he saw you come in, and then two people in after you, and when he looked up, you were just gone, like a ghost." "Well, I walked up the hill," I told the woman behind the counter. "We have a camera where you can see people walking up the hill, and he said you just disappeared." "I don't know. We do have a resident ghost, you know." "Really?" "Yeah, there were a bunch of people here one night, and they were all standing in the aisle. I saw this man, and I didn't remember him coming in. I always greet people as they walk through the door. People were passing him like they didn't see him. He never checked out, but then he wasn't there anymore. I got so scared, I made my best friend come down here and close with me." She leaned closer. "And then another time, I saw him walk through the walls. So I started researching the history of this building. This used to be an Amoco, and I realized that there used to be garage doors where the wall is now. And then I started looking through photographs, and I saw him, the same man that was here in the store. He had been an employee, and once I knew who he had been, I felt relieved. The next time I saw him, I smiled at him, and he smiled back. He's a friendly ghost." I felt keenly aware of the sweat dampening my shirt. "I just finished a book by Margaret Atwood that included a story about ghosts," I offered. "It was fiction, though." "Oh, this is no fiction. I believe every bit of it." Two skateboarders came in, and not waiting around to see if they could see me, I decided to head home. When you love a place, you love even the imperfections. Recently, I took a walk, turning right at the end of our driveway instead of left, a world I had not seen. Beech trees with smooth, light gray bark and subtly sketched shadowy eyes. Huge sycamore trees, brown bark peeling away to reveal pale moonlight, chalk, the finest beach sand. Light touched the beech leaves, turning them deep magenta, orange, yellow, and brown, gradations of life and death condensed in a fringed oval with the tiniest indentations. How similar is the process of falling in love with a place to that of a person? Morgantown is wobbly, teetering, not artificially flattened or rolled out, but rather on edge, rocks having jutted out from the surface at all angles, rocks left where water receded, bared, left to weather above the surface. Sometimes in the forest, the big rocks look like unearthed ships, overgrown with moss, complete with helm, stern, and bow. Coral mushrooms seem to hold memory of the sea, too, as their nearly identical lines grow from soil rather than seabed, vulnerable to the air. Morgantown is a crooked place, with narrow streets and condensed traffic. The roads are half broken, sidewalks begin and end abruptly. Rusted telephone poles shoot out of the middle of sidewalks frequently. Plants sprawl into the streets, vines crawl up wires and fences. I want to know this place inside out, from itself. It's complicated, difficult, imperfect. Part rainforest, part nostalgia, part college. I know the way to campus and back in my muscles now, but I still get lost anywhere else. Used to flat Midwestern grids, my internal compass has not adjusted well to finding the car I parked 3 hours earlier in daylight when I went to visit a friend in South Park. I wandered the streets in the dark, lost. There's the secret sideways concrete stoop we took to get wine. There's the strange drop-off of the parking lot whose concrete steps we hopped onto to get back. There's the pile of trash we passed. Cherry, Clark, Ash, Arch, where is Spiker's upholstery? I couldn't remember. I was cold, coughing, carrying a stack of papers, my coat in the car. There were white streaks in the sky, wisps that looked like rays of moonlight but were solid, perfectly lined clouds. I stopped to take a picture, but it showed up black. I got more and more lost, walking in circles. Brockway, the busy street, the tinted windowed hot spot I'd driven by many times. Kingwood, the hill, one way here, one way there. I knew it was around there somewhere. Morgantown is like Venice, I thought, laughing. In Venice, I felt the city had absorbed the ideas of those who had passed through it. It was smarter than any one individual. It unveiled the illusion of ideas as an individual's possession. Morgantown said, "Open your eyes. Are you lost? What can you see? Concrete, steep hills, abandoned vehicles perpetually rusting, childhood swing sets growing old." If I were walking with her, I'd point out how the yellow wallpaper of the building from across the bus depot had a tear revealing the brick underneath in the shape of Italy's boot. I'd tell her how I stare at it every time I'm waiting for the bus and it makes me think of her. And the time she tried to teach my brittle tree limbs to dance. She put her hands on my hips, pulled gently, naturally, and whispered, "Just pretend you're water." Her hips swayed close to mine. I tried to loosen my shape, bend around her, with her. Morgantown is not surrounded by a body of water, but my body is sometimes water as I move through it, bending here and there through mazes, holes, circles, lost, unmasked. Once in a mysticism class, a teacher guided us into a meditation by reading a passage about Lady Wisdom. We were asked to close our eyes and converse with her. My mind moved to glimpse different possibilities. At the top of a spiral staircase, I could smell something sizzling on a griddle. There was a kitchen floor, flooded with light, and a woman cooking in jeans with holes at the knees and dark black hair whistling. I paused. A version of Lady Wisdom, but I kept going. I saw a barn with holes, pierced with light. Inside, there was a woman made of light rather than blood. Not bright light, but such a soft and natural light that I did not want to open my eyes. I asked her, "How is it best to love?" And she said, "Through me." My tears muddied the beautiful light at her shoulders like a dirty stream polluting a clear river. But I think we all have her in us. Thank you.
Thanks, Rebecca. Okay, I want to thank all of these writers again for sharing their talents with us, both their talents on the page and also just as teachers and people in our program. We have high hopes for you, which I think are maybe the only kind of hopes to have. And I want to thank my fellow creative writing faculty who you've seen tonight, who have nurtured these writers in the art and craft of fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and life. And thanks to Marcia Bissett, who helped put together this reading and does so much for our readings all year, and to Amanda Tustin, without whom no one would be graduating. So, and finally, thanks to all of you for listening. It means a lot to us. Good night.